history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, seemingly ordinary Americans who have gone through truly extraordinary things on our behalf. And hearing about their experiences is good for the rest of us. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and yeah, often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you caught our last episode, you heard a pioneering African-American heart surgeon named Bert Marius share some of his story. If you missed it, pull up episode number 509 at hometownheroesradio.com and make sure you catch the bizarre situation in which being categorized as a Caucasian almost ended up costing him his life. We're going to hear about some more life or death situations today. Some of them may be similar to stories you've heard before. Others may come as a little shocking. Bert had initially enlisted in the Army Specialized Training Program with the hopes of an accelerated path through medical school. He ended up in a segregated unit called the 725th Medical Sanitary Company, with whom he would see duty throughout the Pacific, the Solomon Islands, the Russell Islands, Iwo Jima, the Philippines, and more.
After the basic training, which took about 3 months, they shipped us up to a camp in Pennsylvania. And then after we left there, then they shipped us down to an area right outside of Stockton, California, and they boarded us on a ship. We went from there, first landed in Hawaii. I finally wound up in New Caledonia. And New Caledonia is a French-influenced area. And it was very interesting because the United States of America had an armed depot there, you know, that they collected things and then so on down the line. But they needed, you know, translators. And, of course, they looked at my record. And even though the Army was segregated, you know, I spoke French. So they put me in there to be as an interpreter to the people who in that area who were working there who spoke French. Now, the other interpreter who was there was a white lieutenant from Mississippi. As a matter of fact, he happened to be teaching language, and French was one of the languages he taught in the University of Mississippi. But he grew up in Mississippi. He had, of course, a Mississippian accent. So even when he spoke French, you heard the Mississippi accent in it. Like, if you want to say, do you want something to eat in French? Say, est-ce que vous voulez quelque chose pour manger maintenant? Okay, you want something to eat right now. Well, he said, in his French southern accent, est-ce que vous voulez chose pour manger maintenant? First time I've ever heard French spoken with a southern accent. And they couldn't understand him. And they would turn to me and say, qu'est-ce qu'il dit? What did he say? But I had to be very careful. I had to whisper to them in French, I'll explain to you later. Because I didn't want to explain nothing in front of him. After, you know, he'd finished and told him all he wanted to do, then I would go off someplace and they'd follow me. And then I would tell them in French that they could understand. But I knew better to embarrass him.
Sure.
Because he was a lieutenant, and I was nothing but a private. So anyway, after that is when we moved to places like Guadalcanal and all that sort of stuff, and there were all kinds of experiences. And since we had medical associated with us, they did not arm us.
And let's explain that for people listening. So you're an all-black unit. Mm-hmm. That is in the Pacific, and you're following along with the 1st Marine Division. You're attached to the 1st Marine Division. But what was your job? What were you guys supposed to come in and do?
All we're supposed to do was to take care of all of these things like disease, insects, and stuff like that. If there were some certain flies and stuff, we would, to get rid of them, we had the stuff to spray, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Dig the ditches, to drain the swamps, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That's what we did. And then of course, when things happened, to bury the dead. Now, what happened, as a matter of fact, it was in Iwo Jima. When we were going in the invasion of Iwo Jima, they had the two units. So one had to go in because there were certain insects and flies and stuff, and that carried a certain amount of certain diseases and stuff that they had to go in to take care of. So they flipped a coin to decide which unit would go in. No, it was a straw, the short straw and the long straw. So we'd pick the right straw. So they had to go in first with the 1st Marine Division. And there in Iwo Jima, they had caves up there, and the Japanese had the guns and all that stuff on tracks. They pulled them back into the cave. So even though they bombed all the areas and stuff like that before they sent the troops in, they had all the major troops and stuff all back there because there was an airport there that the United States wanted to control and take over. But anyway, when they first sent the 1st Marines in, they also sent the 727th because the 727th lost and they went in. Now, there's 125 people belonging to each one of those groups. Only 3 of them made it back. All the rest of them got killed. Now, if we had gone in first, we would have only had 3 left. Yeah. So the Lord was looking out after me and that group. So, and a lot of things happened like that. And at Guadalcanal, almost got wiped out at Guadalcanal because there, the Japanese at that time, you know, had their planes, and we didn't have the fast planes to keep up with them at that time. And they hadn't just put them out yet. And so they would come in and they would bomb the heck out of the areas. And we were in foxholes and they bombed us for 2 weeks and stuff like that. And all kinds of people got killed and so on. But I made it through. And as a matter of fact, the Lord blessed the heck out of me because the whole 3 years or so that I was over in that South Pacific, I did not get one disease. As many enough of these mosquitoes as I got bitten with, I never got malaria. I never got any of those other diseases and all those other people got shot all around me, and I never got one injury. The Lord was looking out for Bert Marius because I wasn't looking out for myself. but the whole issue is, you know, and we went in on the invasion of Cebu and Leyte and in the Philippines and so on down the line. And as a matter of fact, when we were in Batangas on Leyte, is where we were staying, the 101st Airborne, we heard that they had decided to attack us. And they came by with machine guns and everything like that. And fortunately, we had heard that they were going to. So we had gone to a storage area there, and we talked the guys into giving us guns and stuff. And so we were able to shoot back and ward them off and stuff. But they came, the 101st Airborne came through there with motor vehicles and all that stuff to wipe us out completely.
Why would they do that?
Because we were colored and they were white.
Now, I know you've told me a lot of stuff that most people have never heard before, but that's, I mean, I don't think I'd ever consider that. And I've talked to 101st Airborne guys.
The 101st Airborne was both in the Pacific and in Europe. Yeah. All right. So it's the particular groups that you're dealing with.
So what did you guys hear, and why did you believe that your own men would come after you guys?
Well, because, number one, when we were camped in Pennsylvania, they also did some attacking on blacks. So some of it happened right here in the United States of America. And it also happened in the capital of the Philippines.
What happened in Pennsylvania? Was this while you were there? You saw and heard about this?
Yeah. Some whites attacked, and they had German prisoners there. And they treated the German prisoners better than they treated the black troops. See, back then, when they talked about prejudice and segregation, they weren't jiving. They meant it 100%. The young blacks today have no concept of what segregation really is.
And where was that in Pennsylvania?
Camp Reynolds, Pennsylvania.
Okay. So when you say they attacked some of the blacks, mm-hmm. people actually die or just wounded or what?
Oh, yeah, they kill some. But you see, it's hard to believe, you know, today. It's hard for me to explain that to young people today because young people today tend to make a universal attitude about something. Mm-hmm. Now, you got a certain a group of people acting a certain way, and they apply that to every white person. So, you know, to tell them that, you know, say, this doesn't mean that every white person has that kind of attitude. Now, most of the whites in the Army, no. All of the 101st Airborne did not have that attitude. You know, so don't blame that on the whole 101st Airborne. These are certain group of the 101st Airborne that acted that way. Just stop and think about it. We're out of slavery in America, not only because blacks stood up for what they wanted to stand up for, but because you had certain groups of white people who went to work to change that situation. So, you know, they say, well, whites this and whites that. Well, of course, you had whites in that wrong thing, but you also had whites doing what is right. So you have to judge people, you know. It's like I have old saying, and I say, figures don't lie, but liars sure enough can figure.
That explains it. And so what you're saying here in the Philippines is that you guys, as an all-black unit, hear that some bad actors have it out for you and are actually going to come fire on you guys, even though you have no weapons.
They thought we had no weapons, but we did.
Because you heard they were coming.
Yeah. But besides that, we had gotten weapons not only because of that, but we had gotten weapons because even though they didn't arm us, they sent us in areas where snipers were shooting at us, and we couldn't protect ourselves, and they didn't send troops to protect us.
And I'll step away from that specific instance for a moment to ask you a general question. Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that? Did you feel like you guys were second class or expendable or sacrificial lambs?
No, that is not the kind of attitude that we blacks took at that time. When you were in the Army, and of course you had a whole different attitude about your enemy. Now, World War II was about the end of true world wars, true war. In World War II, the people you fought against was your enemy. Your job was to kill all of them or get killed and control all of them or be controlled. Not like today, where they go into these various places, allow them to continue to operate and help them trying to operate the right way. When we went into the Army of Occupation in Japan, and I was in the Army of Occupation with Douglas MacArthur, Doug MacArthur took over the government completely until, as a matter of fact, they moved and took away the Japanese yen and made it worth nothing and replaced it with the American type of yen. So until you got the Japanese controlled, so we understood that those were our enemies. Whatever they did, we suspect they were trying to get rid of us, so we got rid of them first. So it was a whole different attitude.
So you're saying that even though you guys weren't a combat unit, you actually engaged in combat with the Japanese?
We engaged. They were the enemy. We had some problems with our country, but they were the major enemy. And we weren't over there to solve prejudice. We were over there to take care of the enemy that had attacked America. And we understood you could not solve the problem in the United States of America if the Japanese controlled America. Right. So we had to get rid of that enemy first, and that's where we focused. So we didn't have the kind of attitude, well, I'm not going to work hard to do what is right to save America and hold up the American flag because they ain't treating us right. No, we didn't have that kind of attitude, you know. It's like I tell people, say, we grew up understanding life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not like you young people today. Life, liberty, and happiness without pursuit. You just go out just simply because you woke up in the morning, you're entitled to everything I got. You're entitled to produce or have the opportunity to produce. But you're not entitled to the product. But that's how they feel today.
But just so I'm clear, even before this incident with the 101st Airborne, you guys, for your own self-preservation, had found weapons here and there?
Oh, yeah.
And did you have to use them against the Japanese?
Of course. We got in positions we had to use them to save our lives. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And how terrifying was that whole situation for you to be in those situations so far from home, knowing that any day could be your last?
Well, you had an attitude, and I know, and I can only talk about my own attitude. I never expected to be able to return back to the United States of America. My attitude was, I am most likely going to die over in the South Pacific. So I did everything to keep me alive every day. But I never expected to get back home.
And what would you say were the times you look back on now as the close calls, as the closest you came to not coming home?
Well, one of the closest was when we hit Cebu City. We were on the ship, and we were not supposed to leave the ship because there were snipers in the city. But a group of us got together and said, Lord, you know, we've been all this time in the South Pacific and stuff, and of course, you know, the inhabitants were moved away, and we never ran across any women or anything like that, you know, and so on down the line, except, you know, nurses and stuff in the army. So, man, you know, we get into Cebu City, we might find some nice women we can work with. So what we did, we volunteered to help take some of the things off the ship, you know, down to the port. And, of course, what we had planned is once we got down on the port, we would take off to Cebu City. So we were there sitting down in this square in Cebu City. We were there and we're drinking our booze and talking about, you know, where we're going to go to hunt up the women. And all of a sudden, the snipers opened on us.
As you might imagine, that did not end well. We'll hear the rest of that story and the difficult lesson he learned there when we come back, plus some of the other hazards he faced and the ways Bert found to help his fellow troops in that segregated unit. Find photos and videos of Dr. Marius at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and more with Dr. Fitzalbert Marius of Fresno, California. Born in Panama, he grew up in Harlem. At age 95, he continues to use so many of the amazing skills and talents that included performing heart surgery until just a few years ago. But we never would have seen all those talents emerge if he didn't survive World War II with the 725th Medical Sanitary Company, an all-black unit that followed the 1st Marine Division throughout the Pacific. When we left off, he and seven other men from his unit had disobeyed an order to stay aboard ship and out of Cebu City in the Philippines. They were looking for a little fun and relaxation when Japanese snipers started to fire on them.
And this guy named Arthur was sitting next to me. Now, I'm here and you, Arthur, there, and I'm looking him in the eye, and the snipers opened up and a bullet hit him right in the middle of the forehead and killed him right there with me looking dead at him. Anyway, the rest of us, there were eight of us, we all ducked down and stuff, and we got away from there and returned. Now, we had to report the death. So we reported the death and of course, had to be honest and tell the captain, you know, how we managed to get there in the first place. He didn't put us in the brig, but what he did was this. He turned to me, because I was a corporal at the time, and he said, Corporal Marius, you are now responsible for alerting his parents of his death. And he put that epos on me. And it was a tough one because he wouldn't have died if it hadn't been us talking into doing that. So that was one of the closest, you know, because I came across a lot of other things like, you know, bombs and stuff like that and rockets and things like that. But I was very, very fortunate. I didn't get not one injury the whole time. God was looking out for me.
And how hard was that to write that letter to his family?
Oh, man. It was really tough. I would have rather he stuck me in the brig than having to take that accountability. Yeah. Ooh, because, you know, when you're feeling guilty about your accountability in that and responsibility in that situation, and now you got to face a mother that you feel is you happen to be partly responsible for the death of her son. Oh, man, that was heavy on my butt.
And just hearing you talk about everything else and hearing you process the things that your remarkable life taught you, why do I have a feeling that that incident, that scenario, that real unfortunate incident taught you something?
Oh, naturally it taught me something. You know, let's face it, a lot of the things that you learn comes from the hard mistakes that you made. It's things like, for instance, Dr. Lowe, you know, in cardiac surgery, when you put into the aorta, the major thing that you pump the blood back into the patient, you know, from the heart-lung machine. So it's a hole that you put a purse string around it and you tie it off and stuff like that. But then you have a small hole, which is kind of a needle hole, where you put a special good-sized needle where you clamp off the difference between that, and that's the one that you feed in the cold thing to stop the heart so that you can work on it. Now, Dr. Lowe, everybody else, when they take this one out, they tie it, and then they put extra stitches and maybe sometime even a patch across it because it's a decent hole. But the little string that comes out that little needle hole, they just tie that off. Dr. Lowe, on the other hand, he treats the other one, you know, routinely, but he puts extra stitches and a patch across the needle hole that comes out. If you didn't know, now I was there when the incident occurred at Children's Hospital, so I know why he did it. He did it because one day that needle hole thing broke and the blood started pumping out of there, and we had to save the patient's life. Before we could get the patient back in surgery, he and I had to open up the patient's chest, reach in and put our finger, and sew that hole up right there to save that patient's life. So from that point on, so his experience with that problem is what caused his reaction afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with us. A lot of things that we do is based upon the experiences that we have gone through. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there is no experience that does not has an effect on your affect.
Well, I don't want to pry or put words in your mouth, but was the lesson of that experience with Arthur's death, was the lesson, don't put yourself in those kind of situations? Or what was it?
Well, the situation mostly was telling you, do what is right. Follow orders. You were told to keep your butt on the ship. You did not follow orders, and you're paying the consequence. You pay the price for the choice you make. And I'll say this about me. I have never been one who avoided saying that I'm paying the price. I have never been one who look around and make an excuse and say, well, if so-and-so made me do it. I go and look in the mirror first thing, and I say, Bert Maris, what did you do? Because most of the things, even, you know, in my first marriage, you know, my wife there, after 19 years, I got married in July of 1947. If I'd have listened to my mother, I wouldn't have married her. Now, she was a beautiful girl, Dorothy Cottingham. She was a good friend of my sister. And so, you know, just before I went off to the Army, we started dating. I would keep in contact with her, and all of a sudden, I started getting no more correspondence from her. Mm-hmm. And when I got back to America, I found out that she'd married somebody else. That didn't work for her. She married him about a year. And by the time I got back, you know, from the armed forces, she was going through a divorce with him and started wanting to redate me again. And so we got together and we started going out. And I went to my mother and told her that we were planning to get married. And my mother, she was always very straightforward. She said, Bert, she's a beautiful girl and nice intelligent, a very nice person, but she's not the one for you. So I said, okay. So I went to my adopted uncle, Dr. Cyril Oliveira, and I asked him. Now, he was always very plain. He said, Bert, he said, now, if I tell you don't marry her, you're going to say I'm keeping you from the most important, greatest thing in your life. Now, if I tell you to marry her and it goes wrong, you're going to blame me. So do what the heck you want to do.
Well, and you mentioned getting home from the war and all that. I don't want to miss anything else about your time in the Army that stands out for you. And I'm curious about those guys that you served with. It's been so long now. How do you think they should be remembered? What was the significance of what you and those other guys did over there? And what do you think the impact of it was?
Well, it was an interesting unit because you only had three men there in the unit outside of the officer, you know, who was white, who had more than a second, third, or fifth grade education. They were from Biloxi, Mississippi, all of that unit except us. Now, my good friend who was from Boston, myself, and this guy, Arthur guy, who was from Chicago, we were the only ones with college education. As a matter of fact, when I found out, I went to the regional commander, and I asked him, was it all right if I started classes to teach them? Most of them couldn't even write or read. So they gave me qualifications to teach them basic fundamental subjects, and they would get credit for it back in America. So I started classes, and a number of those guys hated me because of that. They were saying, because I had intel, I wanted to make them look stupid. But my attitude was not that. My attitude was to teach them, you know, to help them. But they didn't take that attitude. And one of them who claimed he was a preacher of God, we were chopping down trees and stuff in the swamps, and somebody said, look out. And I turned, and this axe was coming towards my head. He was trying to chop my head off. And I had my axe, and I blocked his. And anyway, at that time, I was really tough and strong. And as a matter of fact, after I beat the heck out of that sucker, and I had him underwater and was going to choke him to death, they saved his life by taking my butt off of him. But he wanted to kill me. But then later on, he come wanted to invite me to come to services with him. I said, well, I'm going to go to services. This sucker wanted to kill me. He called himself. But I taught a number of them how to read and write. But in those days, they weren't as strict. They needed fighting men, and they needed men to do certain jobs, and they didn't give a hoot whether you could read, write, or whatever. Just follow the orders. So, yes, those men needed a lot of help, and, you know, I had a lot of things that I still, you know, based upon the kind of background and traditions that I grew up in among my family, that you be productive. You know, I tried even then to be productive. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I painted a lot of watercolor paintings while I was over there, and I mailed them out and stuff. I have no idea where they are. You know, I don't even remember who I mailed them to or anything like that. So I don't know how many paintings I got around anywhere.
What were you painting? What was the subject of those?
I paint the scenery, you know, and the situation. I do a painting, a watercolor painting of a group of men, you know, of national people, you know, whatever.
Where'd you get your painting supplies? I mean, I've had a lot of guys say they couldn't even get food or rations, so how'd you find painting supplies?
You could get painting supplies. Remember, the armed forces had places you could buy things and stuff. They brought those things with them. And, of course, you're in certain places. All these places, you know, in certain cities would have some of those things. You know, they'd have stuff. You could find it.
You mentioned Iwo Jima. When you guys draw straws, the other unit goes in and they're decimated. All but three of them are killed. What about you having to deal with the deaths of people you had come to know? How difficult was that?
Well, you got acclimated to that. It's still the same, you know, people you know and losing is no different then than it is now. Except for the fact is, you know, you have a war attitude that everybody is subject to soon death, including you. That's part of your everyday situation. You wake up. The more you protect yourself and the more you do right, the more potential you have of continuing another day.
And you mentioned that your duties at times included burying the dead. What was that like for you? How difficult was that? How challenging was that?
That was extremely challenging because now you are not talking about burying one or two people. You're talking about getting one of them big ditch diggers and digging out a big trench and then shoving in 100, 200, 300, 1,000 people and then covering them over.
Is that American? Is that Japanese? Is that both?
Both, depending on the situation. Now, with the Japanese, you don't worry about IDs and stuff like that. But with the Americans, you make sure you got the dog tags off of them so, you know, had identities. But you burying human beings with a bulldozer ain't fun. But you do develop a way of handling it so that you can survive because you have to have an attitude of survival. The Japanese had a way, you know, on some of those islands we were on, they would have big speakers. On the speakers, they'd have a beautiful Japanese woman, you know, and as a matter of fact, it was one girl who grew up here in America, and she went on back to Japan and worked as one of her, their propaganda thing, yeah, Tokyo Rose. And they'd be playing these blues and stuff. Then they would play a song like, "You had a woman you thought you could trust, but I just found out she's cheating on us." Then they announce, "Why are you colored ones up here fighting against us Japanese while the white man is back there sleeping with your wife?" But we had to learn to ignore. We learned and enjoyed the music and would dance to the music, but we wouldn't ignore what they were saying because we knew it was propaganda, because we knew darn well if they weakened us, they'd come and shoot our butt the same way that they would shoot the others.
If there's anything else about the war years, feel free to mention it. I don't want to miss anything. But when you found out that Japan had surrendered, what was that news like for you?
Well, the news was excellent because what had happened, they had loaded us on a ship. We were heading towards Okinawa. We went through one of them cyclones, and sometimes the ship was up like this. One time the ship like that, we weren't going down, and we all fell right straight down the stairs because we couldn't hold on. Yeah,
because the ship's going vertical in these waves from a typhoon.
Yeah. So, and it was during that time they bombed Nagasaki with the atom bomb and so on down the line, and the Japanese surrendered, and we moved away from heading to Okinawa. They headed us right into Japan. We landed in the city of Yokohama. We became part of the Army of Occupation. That was the time where they had that tremendous 8.5 something earthquake in Japan. It caused the tsunami and all that sort of stuff. And that was the first earthquake I ever experienced coming from New York. Yeah. I had never had. And the barracks, I was on the second floor of the barracks, and the barracks was 120 feet long. My bunk was at one end of the barrack, you know, almost down to the other end of the barrack, and I was laying on the bunk on this cot. And this earthquake started and scared the heck out of me. By the time the thing ended, my cot was all the way on the other end, 120 feet away. I hadn't let go. I was holding on to that rascal. And a whole lot of people got killed in that earthquake and stuff like that. And that's where, when I was in Japan, both Americans wanted to force the Japanese to learn to speak English. But I had always been just the opposite. When I was in a foreign land, I liked to learn their language so I could speak. So I made friends with a Japanese professor, former Japanese professor of the University of Tokyo, and I used to go by there every night. He taught me how to speak Japanese, but he taught me an easy way to speak Japanese so that I could communicate. He said, instead of going through all these declensions and all these things, all I'm going to do is I want you to concentrate on only two verbs. One, which you apply to things which are active, and the other things you apply to things which are passive. And the verb for passive things is des, D-E-S-U. And the active thing is mas, M-A-S-U. He said, and I want you to understand certain kinds of things. Japanese have suffixes following words. Anything that ends with W-A means it is the subject. If it ends with N-O, it means it is possessive. And, you know, dative and so on down the line. Says, and if it ends with ka, the sentence ends with ka, K-A, It's a question. So if you hear, you know, they ask you a question, even though you don't know what it is. So he said, you just learn, you get yourself a vocabulary and learn this. Like if you wanted to say, where is your house? He said, now house is uchi. Where is doko? You is anata. It's a passive sentence, so is des in the present sense. And it's a question, so it'll end with ka. So your house, anata is you, and that's possessive, you then no after it. So anata no, house uchi is the subject, wa would be behind it. Mm-hmm. Anata no uchi wa, where is doko, is passive, so is des. It's a question, so it's ka. So it'd be anata no uchi wa doko des ka. And so I was able in a short period of time to learn to speak the language because he made it so down to earth. My house is Wataxi. Wataxi no uchi wa toi desk. My house is very far. Uh-huh. You know, so as a matter of fact, after I came back to America, I was able to teach some Japanese students here how to speak their own language because of him. But now, you know, and I still remember some of it, you know, after 60-something years of not even using it because of the way he taught me how to speak that. Now, Filipino language, on the other hand, Tagalog, whoo, not so easy, very difficult. It's a beautiful Polynesian language, but it has some Spanish in it. But it has, like, if you have a thing, pag, if you add e-big after it, it means one thing. If you add mag in front of it, mag, pag, e-big, it means something entirely different. The root word doesn't even count. But it's a beautiful sounding language. But man, it was difficult. But I, as a matter of fact, back in there, I still got the dictionary that I hand wrote. I hand wrote, yeah.
Well, speaking of the Philippines, that reminds me, I don't think I ever settled with you the end result of that issue in Batangas, where you guys catch word that your own guys are coming your way. Did people die in that clash with the 101st Airborne and your outfit?
Yeah, some people died on both sides, but nothing happened.
Isn't that depressing to realize that you guys wearing the same uniform killed each other?
Well, the whole issue was we were thankful we were still alive, and that's all. We were still over there fighting the war. Not only that, but we still had some enemies. There were groups of people in the Philippines who were as dangerous, attacked you. If you were leaving Batangas and going towards the capital, you had to be careful because those snipers would be shooting at you on the way. You were still at war.
And we're not done with his war story yet, not to mention 55 years as a heart surgeon or his perspective on racial relations in America today. We'll try to squeeze it all in with Dr. Bert Marius when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our eye-opening discussion with 95-year-old Dr. Fitzalbert Marius of Fresno, California, one of nearly a million African-Americans who served in our armed forces during World War II. I've talked to people who have said they felt that the African Americans who fought in World War II, whether they're, you know, flying planes like the Red Tails, the Tuskegee Airmen, or they're in segregated engineer units in Europe, or like you, this medical sanitation outfit in the Pacific, that what you all proved was even though you weren't treated the same here in America, that you didn't have the same rights as other races, that what you proved over there was if you could fight and die for our country, you deserved all those rights. You shouldn't be any other kind of citizen than the white citizens. Did you see that happen in the wake of World War II? Did you see things change? And do you feel that what you and those other black soldiers did had a role in it?
Yes, I'm sure it had some influence. But the amazing thing was this. When President Franklin D. Roosevelt died and Harry Truman took over, I became immediately depressed because here, this president was born in Missouri, a southern area. So there was no way in the world. Now, if I thought, you know, prejudicial things were running bad under Franklin D. Roosevelt, it was certainly going to be worse under Harry Truman. But to my amazement, Harry Truman removed discrimination from the armed force.
He integrated all of them.
That's right. He removed it completely, did exactly the opposite of what I expected. So that's one of the greatest things that Harry Truman did during his administration.
Well, and he did it. I wasn't alive. I didn't see it. But don't you think one of the reasons he did it is because of what you guys did in the war and what you proved you were capable of, the allegiance and loyalty that you proved, even though you weren't getting everything you deserved here?
Well, I think Harry Truman did it because he had a heart change, personal heart change, and that's why he pushed it and did it. So he saw it was wrong, and he saw that all citizens should be treated exactly the same if they're going to sacrifice their lives for the country. So yes, he made a start for it. But remember, all of this went on, but it was not until you started to get to the times of Martin Luther King and all of those kind of, like I'm demonstrating that big painting in there, that you began to actively begin to change the civil rights situation, you know, little by little. One of the things that you began to notice was that the greatest change in attitude came among the Southerners, because the Southerners had a very definite anti-black attitude. And when their heart changed, they had something to change from. Now, this northern districts like New York and so on down the line, where everything was subliminal, on the surface they said certain things, but underneath they were operating on a different level. So you still had subliminal, prejudicial things going on based upon economics and attitudes and all that sort of thing in the northern areas, which were harder to get rid of because they didn't start out the same way. Because they didn't start out, it's like the Bible says when they talk about the church at Laodicea. God says, I'd rather you be hot or cold, not lukewarm. Because I don't know which side of the fence you're on. But if you hot and I want you cold, then I know where you are. If you're cold, I know where you are. And I can deal with where you are. But if you're lukewarm, I don't know whether you're hot or cold. So where am I going to start from? So, and it's the same thing. You got either be hot or cold. And like the book of James says, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. No in between.
Well, I'm thinking about this now. And you described some of the things you went through in the military. Mm-hmm. And you said very frankly that you didn't expect to make it home from that.
No.
But you did. And that kid, that same young man who was hung upside down with his face in a barrel of oil about to die, would go on and become a pioneer in heart surgery. So how did that happen? Was it really your time in the military that turned your attention and focus toward a career in medicine?
Well, the real story is this. I got into it because of the ASTP program.
Right.
All right. It was economic thing. It wasn't coming from my heart. It was an intellectual decision.
You say, I can get through med school in half the time. Why would I pass that up?
And not have to work as hard as I have to if I'm doing it all on my own. Okay.
Which would have worked if you were white, which you were for a while, a few months.
Yeah, but under different circumstances. But when I got discharged in 1946 and went back to New York City, I went back to finish my last 2 years of college and pre-med, and I graduated in 1948. I was a very good student, top 10 of the class, magna cum laude and so on. I applied to medical school, and the first year out, I worked all day as a tailor, and at night I went to Hunter College and took a course in medical illustration. Now, medical illustration is associated with what? Art. So I hadn't given up my art. At the end of the first year, some of my students came out and says, hey, Bert, how come you're not in medical school? You were, you know, top areas of the class. Did you apply to medical school? I said, yeah, I applied to medical school. Did you apply to Howard or Meharry, the two black medical schools? So I said, no. They said, where'd you apply? I said, well, I applied to Columbia and various, you know. They say, you know darn well them white schools ain't going to let you in. Well, I must have known it. I didn't want to go to medical school anyway. But they got on my butt so hard that to get them off my butt, I applied to Howard. The second year, I worked all day as a tailor. At night, I went to the New York School of Industrial Art and Science, and I took clothing designing. After about 2 months, I said, well, look, I really want to go into art. So I applied to École des Beaux-Arts, Université de Paris. École des Beaux-Arts, a school of wonderful arts, and it was the finest art school in the world at the time, and I got accepted. So I was on my way down with a letter saying, yes, I'm coming. And I had the letter, and I remember I was living on 148th Street between Amsterdam and Broadway, and usually I walked down there at 146th Street on that same side of the street as the post office and drop the mail and then go to 145th Street and take the subway down to work. But as I got to the vestibule, I remember I hadn't picked up the mail for yesterday. So I went to the mailbox and opened up the mailbox, and inside the mailbox was a letter from Howard University. So I opened up the letter, and the letter said, you have been accepted to medical school at Howard University. Send a $50 retainer. At this time, you know, blacks at this time would jump 3 feet up in the air and say, Lord, I'm in medical school. Instead, I took my cap and I banged it on the ground and started cussing and said, God dog, now I got to make a cotton picking decision. And I said, I'm not going to stress myself over this. And I got a silver half a dollar out of my pocket and I flipped it. And I said, if it lands head, I'm going to medical school. If it lands tail, I'm going to Paris. And it landed heads. So I went all the way back upstairs, tore up the letter to Paris, wrote a check for $50, put it in the letter and a stamp on it, and mailed it. And I went to medical school on the flip of a coin. That was God working on my butt, not me. Because later I got to be thinking, I said, now, at this time, I hadn't given my heart and soul to Jesus Christ. I'm the only one standing in that vestibule. I said that to myself. Now, why didn't I, since I wanted to go to Paris, when it landed down, heads, I said, oh, it landed just like I wanted, heads for Paris. I could easily said that. Why did I keep my oath? It was the Lord working on my butt in spite of me. Because if that hadn't happened, no way in the world would I wound up here in Fresno. No way in the world would I be part of working with Byron Evans in 1958 to start the first open-heart surgery here in Fresno. No way in the world would I have, after my wife had divorced me in 1966, would I have met my other wife, Dorothy, and become a Christian. She was part of the influence of me becoming a true Christian and giving myself truly to the Lord and Savior. None of that would have happened. I wouldn't have had my youngest son. None of that. Y'all would be paying big money for dressing up the clothing designed by Fitzalbert Michel Marius.
All the celebrities would be wearing it, right?
That's right. All the celebrities would be wearing it because I would have been the first black designer in the world.
I don't hear you complaining, though. And you mentioned the heart surgery, and you did help pioneer that here in this part of the world 60 years ago almost now. How many heart surgeries did you end up doing before you retired a few years back?
I can't count them. Thousands of them. 15,000 plus.
And I'm sure there's a spectrum on that.
Many of the heart surgeries, like I know people still don't understand, how do you do it? How do you stand up for 10 to 14 hours without eating, without going to the bathroom in one case?
Yeah, people don't understand that because it's so out of sight, out of mind. But it is probably both exhausting and exhilarating task to take on, but so much responsibility. Did that ever get to you, the weight of what you were doing, the life and death nature of this?
Well, for me, of course, it's part of my personality because the Lord has given me a personality from the beginning that when I get involved in something, I'm involved 150% in what I'm doing. I have to work myself in my priorities. So when I get started on an issue, I say, now, is this subject of great priority, or can I put this one aside and something else is more prioritized at this time. I have to make those kinds of decisions, and I make those kinds of decisions all of the time. And what is great priority? Because one of the things that the Lord knows about me, and the Lord knew this, because he has knowledge of all times and of all things. He knew that while Bert Maris was out in the world, I was 199% world. If I made you an oath, you could be sure I was going to keep it. I didn't tell you I was going to do something and didn't do it. And he knew the moment that I truly, with my heart and soul, turned my life and became submissive to the will of God, that same aspect of my personality would come into effect. And it has. And I know the whole issue is people who have known me before saying, you ain't the same Bert Maris I knew before. I knew you when. I said, I'm glad you do. And I'm glad you remember. Because if the Lord can change who I was, he sure enough can change you. And then they shut up. Because I said, I don't deny what I was. But he changed me.
Are you saying the heart surgeon had heart surgery?
Oh, yeah. The heart surgeon had heart surgery. You see, like right now, I tell people, 4 years ago, I stopped being involved in physiological heart repair. And I'm 100% in spiritual heart repair. Mm-hmm. Now.
How old were you the last time you participated in a heart surgery?
Well, it was 4 years ago. So I was 91.
Did your patients know that?
Well, a number of my patients didn't understand. All they know, everybody was glad because, see, like even now.
Yeah, you're holding out your hand, and there is no tremor whatsoever.
Right. The hand's steady as a rock right now. Uh-huh. I could still be doing it right now. I've developed this attitude. If you do 100% of what you're capable of doing, then you don't have any stress or guilt to carry with you. Whatever I needed to do while I was at the hospital, I stayed as long as was necessary to take care of that situation as much as I could do with everything that I had. I never bothered to tell this to others, you know, because when I was assisting, like some would come up to me and says, okay, Bert, now I want you on this case because we're operating on the administrator of St. Agnes Hospital. And I want the very best for him, the best anesthesiologist. You one of the most experienced, and I want one of the best assistants, and so on down the line. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, I'll be there. But what I said to myself was this: they don't know who they're talking to, because every time Bert Maris steps up to that table, whoever is on that table is getting Bert Maris's best. It doesn't matter whether it's the president of the United States, the head of the Ku Klux Klan. If I give an oath that I'm going to take care of you, you want to get 100% of what I got. You say the best, as if the other people aren't getting the best. If it's a bum on the street, he's going to get the same thing the president gets.
I guess here's my question on all that. 55 years of doing these kind of heart surgeries and all those patients that you dealt with, the lives that they led after that, the gift of life you're able to give to so many. What are you most proud of when you think back on that medical career? What gives you the most pride or satisfaction?
Well, the most thing that gives me the pride and satisfaction is that I have come to the point that I understand that anything and everything that Bert Maris is able to accomplish, it is because God gave me the ability to do it. All that matters is whether I am doing it according to his will, not according to my own desire. I can't remember the very last time that I had any anxiety about anything. Just like you see me and most people, and they always ask me, says, how come you always got a smile on your face? I said, because I got joy to come from within. I'm not stressed out about nothing. I go to bed every night absolutely peaceful. I don't have any control, and that's why one of my favorite scriptures is the 47th verse of the second chapter of Acts. After 3,000 were saved, it says, and the Lord added to the church daily. Remind old Bert Maris that no matter how much I teach, no matter how many sermons I might preach, how many books and manuals I write, I don't add one soul to the church. The Lord added to the church. Without him, none of this is possible. You know, being a poet and stuff, I pray this way. Thank you, Lord, for reminding me I'm birthed from dirt and would be completely inert if it were not for you. I thank the Lord for using me to further his kingdom in spite of my human deficiencies and inefficiency. That I'm not taking any credit for any of this myself. The only credit I've taken is the fact that I'm willing to submit to his will and be his steward and his messenger.
And my last question is, because we've talked a lot about the racial situation in this country, and you've seen it evolve over 95 years that you've been alive. Do you have any insight on that and the current state of racial relations in this country that maybe isn't being said out there that you think people ought to consider?
It all boils down to one thing and one thing only. You cannot change the circumstances and the situations without first changing the hearts of the people. We spend too much of our time prioritizing, correcting the symptomatology while ignoring the disease. We need to get to the disease. It's like drugs, for instance. We spend billions and billions of dollars on anti-drug actions. But stop and think about this. 30 to 40 years ago, a big drug bust was one that found 2 liters of heroin. Now today, it's a truckload or shipload of heroin. Is that a increase or a decrease? We spend them billions of dollars. Now we have more drugs coming in because we're not dealing with the disease. And the disease is why people want to use the heroin in the first place. We need to change their hearts. And that's true about many of the things that we're involved in. You wouldn't come to me as a surgeon. I say, oh, you got cancer of the colon. It's just in one place. Let me pray for you, and I'll give you something to make you feel better. You want me to cut your belly open and cut that sucker out and throw it away. Get rid of the disease, not the symptomatology. Uh-huh. And that's the same thing we are dealing with here.
That's the doctor's diagnosis, 95-year-old Bert Marius. He'll turn 96 in March, and he's not slowing down. He continues to teach classes at the Fresno School of Mission. He'll be speaking at a free men's breakfast at the Well Community Church in North Fresno this coming Wednesday morning at 6 a.m. And he also shared a few more of his anecdotes and opinions that we just didn't have time to include on the radio. So if you like, you can find that extra audio at hometownheroesradio.com. An artist, a poet, a tailor, an author, a scratch golfer, a musician, a groundbreaking surgeon, and of course, a veteran of the then segregated U.S. Army in World War II. I'm so thankful Dr. Marius could share with us all the different ways he's exercised his rights and privileges as an American, leaving us reminded once more, as we are each week on Hometown Heroes, that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude.
Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.